This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Siviso, the ETA Health and Living segment, our doctor in the house. It's Friday. Welcome to the show, George. How are you today?
I'm good. Mira, it is a Friday. Yes. It's not raining.
We've missed you. Happy. We didn't see you last week.
I know.
And the week before, I think.
Are you keeping track?
Yes, I am.
All right, okay. I think some listeners out there are keeping track, so they kept asking me whether I've left the country.
Left the country. I don't think we'll be able to get rid of you.
I think you'll be.
I mean, it's been so hard getting rid of you on BFM. What more the country, George? So, 10 years. BFM will be 10 years this year. Dr. George Lee has been with us almost from the
day one.
It's been 10 years.
I'm part of the furniture.
You are. That's you know? But anyway, today we're going to be discussing something interesting. It's about men's health and policy, public health policy. We always talk about the women's issues. Women's health seems to be out there. We use just breast cancer as one example. Nobody really talks about men's health very much. And how does that influence policy? Does that mean you're left out of a national plan or an international plan? What does this mean for the man?
That's right.
I mean, we do know that when it comes to health, your sort of ego gets in the way. Yes, we know that. We know that for sure. But will that work to your disadvantage as a gender in this country? Joining us also, Professor Dr. C.J. Ng. He's from the Department of Primary Care Medicine, University of Malaya. Welcome to the show, Dr. C.J. How are you today?
I'm very well, Mira. Thank you.
Yes, and you and George have worked together before?
Many times, yeah. We were on several collaborations. Yeah. You know, when I was at University of Malaya, we did that. After I left, we collaborated on male hormone testosterone trials together. We spent Saturdays and Sundays, you know, haunting those men, you know, taking blood, injecting them with all sorts of, you know, medications for research purposes.
And what were the findings? Can you remember?
Yeah, definitely. It's landmark trials.
Okay. Please tell us about it.
Okay. Would you like to elaborate a little bit about our, you know, testosterone deficiency syndrome studies?
Yeah. I think that's a sort of a smallish study. It's not a big study. So it contributes to existing evidence about testosterone deficiency syndrome. So basically, it's trying to aim at looking at the symptom score, what we call it, the androgen deficiency score, and it shows that it has improved the symptoms of androgen deficiency syndrome.
Can you tell me what this syndrome really is all about?
It's basically due to the low testosterone in men. Okay. As a result, they present with some symptoms. So when the testosterone falls below a certain level, then men still manifest as lethargy, they lose muscle, and then they feel tired. You know, they also lose libido, and the sex drive goes down.
Okay. Well, essentially, you know, you
is
just
it prevalent,
kinda,
though? Is it prevalent?
Well, it is very prevalent. I mean, if you actually look at, you know, some people, there are many terminology describe this condition.
Andropause,
and then, you know, male menopause, you know, late onset hypogonadism. And essentially, it is a spectrum of symptom complex that men will suffer from. For example, getting a bit more forgetful, a bit more moody, putting on weight, and then, you know, getting tired quite easily, falling asleep in the daytime. You know, grumpy old man syndrome.
But you're always in denial.
Exactly.
You make fun of the poor lady.
Exactly. But, you know, talking about hormone changes in ladies, and then, you know, this is what men experience. The thing about, obviously, gender differences between menopause and a woman, there is quite a sudden drop in the hormone, but for men it's gradual and the symptoms are a little bit vague and also it's difficult to identify. However, the true kind of clinical significance of this is that many men may harbour risk of something called metabolic syndrome, which predisposes them to cardiac problems and then also bone health, you know, osteoporosis. And then, you know, all these are the things that we would like to prevent men from getting.
So with reduced testosterone levels, this is what happens. Does every man go through it? At some stage?
No, I mean, it's like, you know, if you look at it, it's like, no, it's like, if you live old enough, you get it, right? Okay.
What is old
but
enough?
Old enough, I say, well, you know, currently it's more than 93.
Yes.
Right.
But, you know, Tunem has come out and spoken about his, you know,
his sexual performance
absolutely,
at some
yes,
point.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not just sexual libido. I mean, it is testosterone protects a lot of other organs, protects the brain. Many people don't know that.
Just like estrogen does.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. And then, so what we are lagging behind in comparison with female hormone replacement therapy is that, you know, female hormone replacement therapy is at least 3 decades ahead in research. And men, we're just beginning to do a lot of work, don't you think, CJ?
Yeah, absolutely. I think testosterone deficiency syndrome is still something that people consider as a bit controversial in the sense that the treatment of it, whether it really improves the long-term outcome or whether it's just basically the symptoms itself. So I think lots more research needs to be done in this.
Yes, yeah. And hence our topic today as to why is it not enough research is being focused on men's health. Do we know why, CJ?
Well, I think we can look at it at several levels. I think historically, right, men has been the, well, still is in some way, is in an advantage position. Men is a stronger sex in terms of physical, well, used to be, okay, psychologically, okay.
We got
stronger.
We got phone calls coming in now.
And then physiologically, but as time goes on, then we realize that lots of focus is actually then try to actually protect the woman and the children because they are being disadvantaged in many ways. So as a result of that, lots of focus of healthcare is on women and children because men is considered as the stronger sex. So as time goes on, I think men get left behind in terms of health, perhaps not in other aspects. So as a result of that, I think men then the life expectancy actually is like 5 years behind.
That's correct. Okay.
So what we're suggesting is that men themselves perceive themselves to be the stronger gender and then set up the women's
and
children's.
I think what CJ is saying is in the community itself, we assume that
the males really need
the stronger gender. Physically, physiologically, perhaps I would agree with you, CJ. I'm not sure about psychologically.
Because,
that's left to be.
Yeah, mental health, men issues, there's a lot more prevalent in mental health.
Absolutely. But, you know, we don't hear much of it.
Absolutely.
Nobody really wants to talk about it. But in general, would you say men are doing poorer as far as their health is concerned compared to the women?
I would say in most of the diseases and in terms of health behaviours, I think I would agree that men actually do much poorer than women. Because if you look at, for example, depression, actually women fares worse than men.
Is that right?
Yes, in terms of prevalence.
You've got any evidence to support
it? Yes, definitely. I think the 2015 National Morbidity Health Survey shows that actually women has sort of a higher prevalence of depressions compared to men. But the suicide rate in men is much higher than women.
So presumably, for women, they are more willingly report this so that the statistics actually reflects that depression rate is higher because their treatment-seeking behaviour is a lot more at ease when they go and see healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. But men probably suffer in silence. Would that be...
Well, actually, the studies conducted are basically across... It's a cross-sectional study.
Mm-hmm.
So basically involves men and women. So the proportion of women that has depression is much higher than the proportion of men who has depression. It's not that they reported more.
Right.
So it's all standardized, validated questionnaire that they used.
Could it be that a woman is just more resilient?
It could be. It could be. What I mean is that, for example, depression, but it doesn't lead to them killing themselves, like suicide, whereas men... You know, probably women would talk about it, seek help.
Coping mechanisms
so much better. They have a better social network as a whole, so compared to men. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why they don't die from depression, but men do.
But then there's also this cultural perception, isn't it, that men are stronger. How much does cultural perception sort of affect masculinity when it comes to health?
Yeah. I think, first of all, we need to know what exactly is masculinity. So it's a term that's been thrown around a lot.
Well, I mean, from a child, you know, you presumably a girl who falls over and then you get all that cuddling and say, oh, I'm sorry that it has happened. And a boy, you just kind of say, toughen up and then, you know, get on with it, right? Would that be building up that masculinity? I mean, how do you define it in a clinical viewpoint?
Yeah.
What is masculinity?
That's right. Clinically, it's quite difficult because this is pretty much a social concept.
Yeah.
So masculinity is what makes a man, basically, in the very brief sense. So, but there are four ways that we can sort of operationalize it. For example, a masculine man is somebody who is more likely to take risk.
Mm-hmm. With somebody, risk-taking.
Yes, risk-taking. The other one is the invincibility, that they feel that they are strong, they're unlikely to fall sick, for example. And the third one, okay, is actually about try not to be like a woman. Of course, you can say, what is a woman like? Right. So one, two, three. And then the last one is they don't want to rely on other person. For example, they, you know, it's like, I want to be independent. Okay. I don't want to rely on another person. So I think those are the four sort of attributes of masculinity. We can, of course, tease it out to see how that itself affects men's health. Yeah.
Have you done any research on it?
Yes, in fact, we did. And then we actually asked men, what do you consider yourself? What attributes make you a man? Uh-huh. Right. And then we conduct a study across different countries in Asia. And we found that in Malaysia, men consider being a family man as masculine.
Ah.
Right, of course, you must say...
Wouldn't that be number three? That is, being a family man is more feminine, so you try to avoid that?
No.
Yeah, but it's all breadwinner, you're providing.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So men put that as priority rather than, independence, don't depend on other people, and then, you know, stronger gender, don't fall ill. And so in Malaysian men... that to be most important.
Family and man, whatever. Family.
Plus, the other thing is the work and money.
Ah.
That too. So
you probably just surveyed the Chinese men, right?
No. No, it's computer-assisted.
All right, so you can't...
Yeah. Shall I leave?
So it's computer random picking up all these men.
Yeah, it's proportionate sampling, we call it. Well, but I must say that, of course, those who answer the phones have a different, a certain characteristics. But I think as a whole, it does sort of reflect, I think, how men think about what makes a man.
So the Malaysian man thinks of himself as a family man. Mm-hmm. He's the one who goes to work and brings in the money.
Yes.
Okay. And the good career to do that.
The provider.
Yeah. The provider. Okay, right. I mean, obviously you said that you did it across some Asian countries.
Countries, yeah.
And how many other countries did you survey?
How did Singapore?
Oh, we didn't survey Singapore.
Okay. Hi,
but, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
How many other countries did you do?
For example, Japan, see, men of honour as a top priority.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think we also surveyed China, which is more in terms of money and work, for example. So it varies across different countries.
Correct, like George, you were right.
Yeah. You're more manly if you drive your Bentley.
I'm very curious. Did you study India, for an example?
We didn't.
Okay.
All right. Which countries did you serve?
I think there were seven countries. So we have, I think, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, China, Malaysia. Oh, gosh.
Indonesia?
Thailand. No, we didn't do
Indonesia.
There's one more. I can't remember.
Okay.
But I must say that this was conducted like more than 5 years ago. So I don't know what's the change. Maybe we should conduct it again to see whether there's change over time.
Sure.
Yes. And historically, there's not been enough focus on men's health at the public health level. Mm. Where do you see Malaysia is at the moment?
Actually, I think we are not too bad because we are actually planning for a men's health plan of action, national plan of action for men's health.
Okay.
So if we get it through, hopefully soon, it will be the fifth in the world.
Right,
after Australia, Ireland, Brazil. Oh, where's the last one?
One more. The BRIC countries.
No, not UK. So there are four of them at the moment, so we might be the fifth one.
But EU, right? I mean, that was put forward to the EU country as a bloc, right?
Yes. In fact, I think currently EU is the WHO in Europe is actually looking at establishing sort of like a EU men's health policy. So, which actually I think Professor Alan Huai, who is the professor of men's health from Leeds, will be presenting his findings in the first Malaysian men's health conference that's coming up in a month's time.
Oh.
that George will be speaking.
That's George. You know.
How can they leave you out from anything related to men's health?
Indeed.
You know what? Our phone lines are open if you want to be a part of this conversation. I want to ask you, what do you think should constitute a men's health plan of action? What areas should we actually include in there? Come on, ladies, I'm sure you have your input as well. We'll also come back and find out why is it we always talk about targeting the women or the spouse or the partner to get through to the man? Is this really the right approach? But, you know, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000, tweet BFM Radio, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. It's Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with me together with Professor Dr. C.J. Ng. He's from the Department of Primary Care Medicine, University of Malaya. We are discussing men's health and public policy. Mm-hmm. Why is it men's health issues seem to be lagging behind? If you look at research, not much money is being put into it. We've discussed some cultural perceptions as to why this could possibly be happening, men's attitudes to towards their health. The last I left off is when we were talking about the men's health plan of action. What mm-hmm. do you think should be part of this men's health plan of action, which, you know, I'm sure they're going to reveal already in August.
Yes.
But do we have any idea?
Yeah, I mean,
at all
presumably
as
you need to
what we're looking at.
You need to look at what is deficient and then where men needs help, right? Okay. For example, early on we talked about suicide rate in men, which is troubling, which obviously is alarming, and that's one area presumably you're going to put forward. Now with the new Malaysian government, the new era, so what plan of action would you propose to the ministry?
George, you're absolutely right, because when we plan a policy, it should address the needs
okay.
of our population. So we try to make evidence-based policy as far as possible, but it's easier said than done. First of all, if you do not have much research in Malaysia about
exactly.
men's health, how mm-hmm. can we then inform the policy?
I think we're just lagging in terms of studies in general
yeah.
for everything, really.
Right. But still, we have to move forward. We can't wait for all the evidence to be there before we move forward. So as a result of this, in 2015, actually, Ministry of Health actually convened a meeting involving different ministries, universities, NGOs together over several meetings to draft this policy or plan of actions, which is due to be out very soon. And you're absolutely right. Because of the National Men's Health, Morbidity and Health Survey
mm-hmm.
results, we found that there's deficiency in many areas.
Mm.
And we put that into the policy.
What are those deficiencies?
And for example, you talk about depression, that we focus a lot on men's health interventions in terms of improving the clinic facilities, for example, the screening tools, and also public campaigns, how to improve
mental health,
yeah, in men. So that's just one example.
But that's just looking at the infrastructure and, you know, from a macro perspective. What about the man himself? He needs, you can get everything right. If he doesn't come forward,
that's right.
What is the point, right?
Absolutely. If they don't seek help,
yeah.
they kill themselves in silence. I mean, we won't be able to solve the problem. So you were talking about getting to men through women.
The women.
Exactly.
We have to do that. On top of everything else.
So when it's okay. You're the savior. Right.
I suppose when we look at policy, we really need to look at it at different levels, at the macro level and then, you know, the meso and the micro level. So what we're talking about, policy change, interventions, campaigns, this is at more at a macro level.
Yep.
But at the micro level, it's such as going to men through women. There are studies that look at effectiveness of getting involving the partners to reach out to the men. And it has shown to be effective. But is it always the case? As a medical doctor, as a primary care physician, I would say no. So generally, I think some men who are more a family man, perhaps, who has good relationships with the wives or the partners, are more likely to respond to this. Some men who are really in my clinic, I mean, I'll see them all the time, that mm-hmm. dominate the conversations. And if they come together with the wife, then, you know, they tend to shut the wives up. So I think those situations then, it won't work.
Okay. I think you need a national action plan as to how to crush that ego first. And then possibly things might move. Chiu, you have a question?
Hi, Chiu. Good afternoon.
Hi, doctors. Yeah, I have a question since we are on the subject of men, health, and testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about the term alpha man.
Uh-huh.
I've read about it, and I just want to have more information in terms of what do they mean by alpha man.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chu.
Okay, CJ, are you alpha male? And what sort of characteristic define your alpha male?
Yeah, carry on. Right. Is there such a definition?
Well, to be honest, I've heard of it, but to be honest, I'm not familiar with it. I don't consider, what I know is that alpha man is somebody who are really sort of portray themselves as a really masculine man.
Yeah.
Who are macho.
Doesn't hide it, lah.
Yeah, exactly. And then see that as to the advantage and use it. Tends to be a bit more aggressive, I would say. And then show the authority. And would be, I would say, more domineering kind of a character.
So leader of the pack.
Yeah.
Really, okay.
So,
but everybody would like to think that they're the leader of the alpha pack.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So, I mean, would that have any clinical impact if somebody who is like, you know, consistently alpha male, presumably someone who is highly self-confident and then, you know, it's, always want to be in limelight and attracting attentions and then, you know, trying to lead the way. Would they have any clinical implications if they behave like that?
I think there's advantage, for example, in the corporate world. That may help in some ways. But when you bring it back to the family and bring it back to your personal life, I think that's going to go against men. Because then they want to portray as very strong, in which case then they may not seek help as early as they want to be. So, and also relationship, for example, with their partners or their children may be affected because they want to dominate or they want to be strong.
But do you think that's sort of changing, George? I mean, from your father's time to you.
That's right.
Do you realise that this definition of what masculinity is isn't as... I mean, it's masculinity, but it's sort of in terms of aggressiveness, in terms of, ego and all of that. Do you see that sort of...
fading.
I wouldn't say fading, but it's you're coming
changing,
to terms with it.
Evolving.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I earlier on, CJ said they study some characteristics of Japanese culture. You know, the Japanese culture is very male dominant and then chauvinistic to some extent. However, whenever they try to adapt to this kind of like metrosexual side of them, it is very difficult because on one hand, you're supposed to be in control and of the situation in at home and in the office and in your career. However, whenever you are losing control, let's say, for example, you face obstacles in your career, you lose a job, and then under those circumstances, you have nowhere to hide because you're constantly in that alpha male mode and then suddenly faced with an obstacle. The only way they seek is just to kill themselves because that's a way just to end it all.
Right.
And I think in many studies, that is a reflection of when an alpha male falls, they fall drastically. And then that is what a lot of men face, I think.
Okay, so we have... Dr. Amir Siddiq, who says men have high rates of suicide due to the method, women increase in terms of attempts. What does that mean, CJ?
Yeah, I think we need to differentiate between suicide and parasuicide. Suicide is when a person dies from killing themselves, and then parasuicide is when they attempt to kill themselves but are not successful. They didn't die from it. So I think parasuicide is common, more common in women, whereas suicide is more common in men.
Okay.
So when women try to kill themselves, they are not so successful. Maybe they didn't do it, you know. I suppose
cut
it deep enough or they're a bit afraid or, you know. Well, and maybe in some way trying to tell people, seek help in a way. Don't mean to kill themselves.
A cry for help.
In a way, yes, absolutely. Whereas men, when they've sort of thought about it, they plan for it, mm-hmm. and when they do it, they kill themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the action plan. What else is in it?
Okay, yeah, it's actually pretty holistic. So it involves...
holistic sounds like mental a whole
health.
Afternoon, right? Okay, right. Mental health, okay.
Mental health.
Yep. Cardiovascular health.
Okay, well, that's important, obviously, because that is the number one killers for men, right? Presumably.
And women.
And women, right, okay.
And of course, cancers. Yes. Cancers is not... The most common cancers remain still colorectal and lung cancer. And of course, prostate cancer is also getting more common. So these are some of the cancers that, you know, we try to differentiate between which are the cancers that can be screened and which are the ones that can be screened at the prevention level. So Currently, the one that's been shown to be evidence for is with lots of evidence is actually colorectal cancer. No. Prostate cancer is still a lot of controversy.
Colorectal is the leading cause of cancer amongst men. Am I correct?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
So we've got cancer, we've got heart disease, and then we've got mental health. What else is in your pipeline of trying to convince the ministry to enhance on men's health?
The other very important thing is pertaining to men's health, so risk-taking behaviour, which means, for example, road traffic accidents. Uh-huh.
That's obviously very important. You know, the sort of like fast driving lifestyle mm-hmm. and that sort of things, and then taking risk in the road, because it's not just themselves they put themselves at risk, because other people, right? The mud rampant culture, that sort of things.
Yes, absolutely.
What about you, George?
I'm trying to learn something here, right? Okay. Look, I'm calming down
being
a bit.
Been in an
I'm
accident just, yourself.
Yeah, several times. I'm just accident prone. It's not because I'm risk-taking behaviour.
Have you heard these excuses before,
I was in a Vespa. I fell on the bike in a Vespa. It's hardly Harley Davidson, right?
Well, okay. Who knows, right? Fast cars.
So, well, yeah, 60 miles an hour.
Risk-taking behaviour. How would you address that?
This is difficult because this is something that have been with them all their lives, and it's very difficult to change. Education is the first step, but it usually is not so effective.
Yeah.
So I think it's to make men realize that the implications of their risk-taking behavior. So what we found in our study is that, you know, at different stages of men's life, they have different priorities. So we found that actually when they get married, that's a good intervention point.
Right.
Oh, so getting married.
Get them
married.
Okay. In a way, then they think about their family. Well, and when they become father, for example.
So you're hardly going to propose to the ministry and say, okay, these are risk-taking behaviour, so in order to solve this problem, marry them all off, right?
No. I've just said these are interventions.
Get them when they're getting married. I mean, CJ, I'm a bit concerned, right? Yeah. Okay, you pointed out several things, right? You pointed out that, you know, cancer is a problem, suicide is a problem, risk-taking behavior in the roads a problem, and you know cardiovascular health is a problem, and then you pointed out all these issues which is blatantly obvious, and then every single one you say, oh, this is difficult to solve, right?
But that's the fact.
That's a reality. Okay.
That's a reality.
Well, I have an opinion about this. Okay, I'm going to propose that I think in a way our healthcare needs to drastically change in order to address all sorts of problems, both in men's and women's health. Okay, let me put it this way. I think there is a disparity between men's and women's health because of two reasons. Number one is that for women, there's constant access to healthcare, even though when you're not ill. Right. Okay. So let's say, for example, a woman becomes pregnant, or let's start with when the menarche starts, the period starts. The mother will take a child to go and see a doctor and say, "Look, you know, this is how you ought to keep yourself, monitored about the hormonal changes." Education. So a young child begin to have access to doctors when they become pregnant. They have access to doctors. When after delivery, they have access to healthcare providers. And then after menopause, they have access to healthcare. But on the contrary, men only go and see doctors when they're ill. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a car, right? A car that is being serviced all the time, obviously it's not going to go wrong. The car that only serviced when it's broken, it's going to go wrong. So healthcare structure itself is wrong to start off with between men and women, because there's no such thing as gynecology equivalent of men's doctor.
EULA.
Yeah, well, I know. But the thing is, that's what we think, right? Because the urologist, by default, actually looks after men, because we look after men with men's organs, right?
Okay. But what about the GP, CJ? Yes. I mean, do you think they have a role to play?
Which is what I think is, because our healthcare is evolved towards specialization, which takes us to my second point, which is fundamentally wrong. Because when you look at specialization, you treat an individual according to pathology, right? Okay, so when somebody comes to see me as a totality, obviously a man who, let's say, has stress related to sexually transmitted infection, and then also a broken relationship, and perhaps some financial issues. So there is complexity. But when he comes to see me, the only thing I can look at is his pathology, that he has contracted some sexually transmitted infection, and then I will just say, I'm sorry, I really don't know how to deal with other issues such as mental health and that sort of thing, because the healthcare is only focusing onto that pathology. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. And then we are shifting away from GP, because we had multiple shows to show that there are all these continuity of care that is provided in, you know, the shop lot doctors who have that track records from cradle to grave is disappearing.
The because, primary healthcare
the primary
system.
Healthcare is disappearing. And in that way, when we're shifting towards specialization, surely that is a wrong direction. You know, because primary healthcare is the backbone of healthcare.
You know, you said something interesting just now, George, in that you spoke about the woman, the young girls who hit puberty and then, you know, mums take them. I would like to suggest that maybe instead of getting them when they get married, let's formulate a way of getting boys when they hit puberty to get educated about themselves. You know, a simple thing like just beyond health as to what is consent when it comes to sex?
Yeah.
They don't even know that.
Yeah.
So much education needs to go into that at that stage.
And even very simple things like, I come across so many boys, even simple things like how to keep the foreskin clean, hygiene,
now
issues
you tell
like
us.
That. That's right, okay. And then they will find embarrassing to even discuss this and say, oh, I didn't know this is supposed to be the case. Like 30 years down the line, they've never retracted the foreskin and they thought that was normal.
But who the question is then, who brings them?
Exactly.
Mum is happy to do it for the daughter, but with the boy.
Yeah. I think in
the father also got issues.
Absolutely.
Right?
The father was brought up just to sort it out yourselves,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So how is you know, daddy going to do that?
In fact, in the men's health plan of action, it does include the schools as well as the target place and work site, because men, you know, adults, men do spend a lot of time at work.
Yes.
So that's another place, setting that we should target, and not just at a clinic level. And George, you're absolutely right. I think the GPs, the primary care doctors, do have a role to play. So I think, you know, when a patient, a person comes to the through the door, the consultation room, you know, when the person, the doctor looks at him or her, it should be looked at him as a person, male or female, and then we manage them differently. So I think the GPs will be well-placed. And the GPs actually provide care over time. So they get to know the person over time, also the family. So
indeed,
I think that will be in a very strategic positions to actually provide
we'll
good
come
men's
back.
Health.
Yeah, we'll come back and find out how men behave during a doctor's consultation.
Uh-huh.
Some of your challenges, you know, so that we can understand this psyche a lot better. If you have a question for us on men's health and public policy, why is it men's health issues are always lagging behind? Priorities don't seem to be put on mental health issues when it comes to men. A whole load of issues. Give us a call. The number is 03-7710-9000. Tweet to BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899.
The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi, our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Joining us also, Professor Dr. C.J. Ng from the Department of Primary Care Medicine at University of Malaya. We're discussing men's health and possibly a plan of action which is going to be revealed in August. Are you excited? Do you think we've covered all of it? Is anything else?
Is anything else
like much more?
Oh, much more.
Please, just quickly
you come to the conference.
Give us a bit of snippet, right?
Are we invited?
Well, you're most welcome.
Okay.
Yes. George will be there.
What else? Very quickly, just generally,
Actually a lot of focus on the health services. How do we improve the health services to make it more friendly to men?
Okay.
And we also look at the public awareness campaigns. How do we want to promote that at different healthcare settings? Particularly, we focus on the workplace interventions, trying to engage the companies to improve men's health by engaging their employees to be stay active, give them incentives. So we try to do that and get that conversation going with the corporate companies.
Okay, yeah. So you're targeting corporations.
As well.
I still think you should get them at puberty. How are we going to do that? I don't know, but I think it will be a lot more effective at that age.
Yeah.
Don't
because,
you think,
George? Because it's changed the perceptions of health as well, you know, because currently, most men will think that you only go and see a doctor if you're ill, mm-hmm. right? And I really
if that also, even if they won't go.
Exactly.
Some of them don't even
so
go.
Because, you know, CG and I run a lot of men's health awareness campaigns. If you do a prostate campaigns and then if you have lots of nice food, they will turn up. But it's the same people turning up all the time. Then you don't attract the right people. It's because of they have certain perception and fear about what we're going to do to them. Right. And then that is the problems that, you know, early on you mentioned exactly why are they so fearful of seeking treatment.
So your campaigns have been a failure then?
Not rolling success.
It should be continuous. And the other thing that I think we should look at is also training the healthcare professionals. It's not just the doctors, really. It's also the nurses, the allied health workers, to sort of make them more aware, looking at healthcare from the gender perspective. So I think as doctors, I mean, men's health was never really taught in the medical school until probably recently. Mm-hmm. So the medical students were not aware of this concept of men's health. So I think that's the other thing that we need to focus on. And of course, the plan of actions also looks at research in men's health. Resources, you know, should be put into researching the men's health so that we create more evidence and then we can improve our policy.
If there's one area we can put it into research for men's health right now, which one would you put it in, CJ?
Well, for me, I will look into mental health because I think that's really a neglected area. Yeah, I don't know about you, George.
Well, I'll put into cancer and sexual health. I think one area that obviously takes two to tangle, and then obviously sexual education, it's a very touchy and sensitive subject, especially in our country. And I really think that a lot of money needs to put into how do men or young boys from puberty age actually perceive sexual health and how do they grow up to respect women and also respect the relationship rather than think of sexual health as a taboo subject that they have to somehow stumble upon and learn from that. I really think that's important. If there are resources available, I really think that we need to know the current state of men and young generations of people, how they perceive sexual health and how that can be changed, research work to be done on that.
Sexual orientation, CJ, that's a huge problem in this country, which leads to a whole load of mental health issues as well.
It's not a problem. I think we problematize it, obviously, you know. I think, interestingly,
not a problem in terms of acceptance.
Yes.
That's what I mean, is as a problem, which with the non-acceptance comes the other issues, the mental health issues and all of that.
From healthcare perspective, I think we tend to focus on the sexual orientation, but actually what we should be looking at is their behaviour. It's the behaviour that leads to some risk of getting certain infections. So I think, you know, sexual orientation, whether it's heterosexual, homosexual, it doesn't matter. It's the risk that they expose themselves to, that we should be focusing on.
So their behaviour that takes
absolutely
goes back to behaviour.
Yeah. Well, one more area which I think is fascinating is to, you know, we talked about how men take risk, how men actually view sexual health and that sort of issues. However, there's one area which some research has been initiated to say how do men initiate healthcare, you know, like, for example, let's use hypertension, for example. How do men one day wake up and say, I would like to seek treatment or I would like to find out what is my blood pressure? So initiation of that. The second part is actually go and see a doctor and accept what the doctor tells you. Because a lot of time men go and see doctors and not necessarily accepting that diagnosis imposed on them. Because if the doctor say, I think your blood pressure is a bit high, they will say, oh, yes, because last week has been busy. I drank too much coffee. I didn't sleep enough. And they will come up with excuses after excuses, not accepting that diagnosis. The next part is once you accept the diagnosis, how do you accept the discipline of putting a pill in your mouth every day religiously in order to protect yourself?
Compliance.
Not necessarily. That is, to start off with, is actually even taking that medicine, because it changed your daily routine, because you, from a well person, suddenly you are labeled as somebody who has got a condition, for you to needing the treatment. So initiation of treatment. Following on that, it's only sustainability of treatment, because we know as well as most physicians that the compliance of a man up to a point of taking the medication, let's say, for example, hypertension medication, it's really rarely go beyond 6 to 8 months, you know, for men who, especially, they don't see a tangible outcome such as hypertension and cholesterol. So those are the issues that you need to somehow work along to help men to sustain that sort of intervention so that they don't put themselves at risk in the future. What do you think?
Are those some of your challenges as a clinician, George?
Those are the challenges, because when we come across a patient, right, okay, in order to convince them what they've got wrong, and also making sure that they are not saying, only saying that, I'm taking the tablets, but they actually don't. Some people just buy the medication and go home and don't take them, which is an issue.
I think a lot of times could be men, but more often than not, it's also the doctor who hasn't really explained to men about perhaps the pros and cons of taking the medicine and get to share the decisions with him. We just tell them, yes, go ahead and take it, without really explaining to him, maybe in details, in the way that he wants, and finding out what his concerns, his expectations, before starting the medications. That might be one of the reasons why he's not taking the medicine. So I think it's both ways, really.
Yeah. Okay. What about your challenges, CJ?
In terms of...
when they come and see you...
In the consultations, it's a spectrum. The man comes in, some of them really come with a shopping list and tell me what are the things they want. Mm-hmm. Not much difference between gender sometimes.
Okay.
But as I said earlier, that some of these men really are dominating the consultations. They're just there to make confirmations, and they're really not listening or trying to discuss their problems. So it's challenging. This group of men is really challenging. On the other spectrum is men that comes in and say nothing. You say, is there any problem you want to tell me? They keep quiet, say, no, everything's fine. But it's the wife or the partner or somebody or the children who might then say, you know, he has a lot of problems, and why don't you tell the doctor that? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is range. And to me, I think it's my duty then to try to control the man who is really come with a shopping list and then say, you know, which are the ones that you want, really? And on the other hand, the other man that is not coming out, and it's really the typical invincibility kind of concept man, that... you know, you have to really be patient with them.
Please tell me the majority are in between.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're right.
Okay. So it's just this group on, you know, the two extremes.
Yes. Either end of the spectrum.
Yes.
Okay. So generally, they are okay.
They're all right. Yeah. Yes. I find that if, you know, you talk to them, nice to them, pay attention to them, listen to them, they'll open up and talk to us.
Okay. So I think I'm very proud that we have a men's health plan of action in the pipeline, which will be revealed, because even on a global scale, men's health sort of takes a back seat, am I correct? So are you looking forward to that, CJ?
Absolutely.
George?
I think so. But you pointed out something that is really crucial. Even we have plan of actions that we change the structure, we change everything, but if we don't change the mentality, it will be a pointless exercise. So I think shows like this brings awareness of how men's health is, men are compromising themselves in their healthcare. CJ pointed out the first question you asked him was like, you know, what's the differences between men and women? He said that men is a stronger gender. But what is the most obvious disparity is men die younger. And then so that disparity is just absurd, that, you know, you're a stronger gender, but you die younger. A lot of time we think is a risk-taking behavior, is that drinking too much, smoking too much, you know, not really looking after yourself. But sometimes there's also that societal expectation that put them at risk. So if we all change together, you know, both the partners of society change together to actually say it's okay for men to go and see a doctor, that is not a reflection of a weakness, I think that is a step in the right direction.
Your message, CJ?
Yes, and I think, George, you're right. I think men, we always focus on the men, but the partners, the family also play an important role. And I think as clinicians, as healthcare professionals, I think we also play a role. We need to be trained to how to interact with men and address the men's health problems, and also, of course, the healthcare policy makers. They need to seriously look at it and make evidence-based policies based on research, for example.
So get them at all levels.
Yes.
Okay.
And get the women, apart from doing everything else, look after us as well, please.
I would say your biggest challenge is to shatter that ego. You haven't told me how that should be done, but if you do that, I think a lot of your issues will be addressed.
Yeah.
But it's a gradual process. It's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Professor Dr. CJ Ng, Department of Primary Care Medicine, University of Malaya, and Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in our Doctor in the House series on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.